Hello, welcome to Bare Naked Politics. This is the podcast for people who want to keep up with the news, but who aren't necessarily politics wizards. If you don't know everything about politics, it's sometimes kind of hard to keep up with the news, but that's okay. I'm going to explain everything to you right now. I'm Julia Bell, by the way. I'm the poor soul who's decided it's somewhat of a good idea to talk you through this madness. But listen, no fluff today. Let's just get straight into it, because Sue Gray, the civil servant who was assigned the task of investigating the absolute litany of reports of Christmas parties, leaving parties, garden parties, birthday parties in Downing Street during restrictions or lockdowns during the pandemic, she has released her findings to the public. Now, the good news is that we are now able to read the words that Sue Gray has written herself before we all keeled over and died from old age. This has been delayed and drawn out to a point for a while where I thought we were just genuinely, are we going to get to a point where we never actually read this report? So that's something. But the bad news is the report has been extremely pared down. It's literally 12 pages long, and even most of that is just annexes and context. The actual meat of it, so the actual findings, take up a page and a bit, you know, and it's quite big font as well. In this episode, I will explain why it's so pared back and why this has been such a colossal faff, but the most interesting bit is what it actually says. So let's just discuss that in full, first of all, shall we? Let me pull it up here and just chew over it with you. Okay, it has 7 bullet points with 7 different general findings. That's the way she's termed it. And then it has 1 conclusion at the end. The first bullet point reads, quote, "Against the backdrop of the pandemic, when the government was asking citizens to accept far-reaching restrictions on their lives, some of the behaviour surrounding these gatherings is difficult to justify." The behaviour around these gatherings is difficult to justify. That's literally the first, like, bam, you know, first finding in this report. And it kind of goes on along that rather disparaging vein. Shall I continue? And you can just sort of let this wash over you. Second bullet point reads, "At least," quote, "at least some of the gatherings in question represent a serious failure to observe not just the high standards expected of those working at the heart of government, but also of the standards expected of the entire British population at the time." So a clear point about double standards there, a quote unquote serious failure to meet the standards that they set for us, the mostly law-abiding public. This is no joke. But anyway, third bullet point, quote, "There were failures of leadership and judgment by different parts of Number 10 and the Cabinet Office at different times. Some of the events should not have been allowed to take place. Other events should have not been allowed to develop as they did." I mean, you can't get more clear than this. Even though it's incredibly general, she's not giving us any specifics on what she actually found. She is saying that the parties shouldn't have happened. They were unacceptable. You know, that's what this is saying. This fourth bullet point really got me. It kind of surprised me, and I don't know why. This is what it says, quote, "The excessive consumption of alcohol is not appropriate in a professional workplace at any time. Steps must be taken to ensure that every government department has a clear and robust policy in place covering the consumption of alcohol in the workplace." I don't know. I said that surprised me because it kind of, I mean, look, we've seen headlines for months about the drinking culture at Number 10. And again, there's nothing new or shocking about this finding intrinsically. But to see it come in fourth place out of 7 in a Cabinet Office inquiry, an official investigation, implies that this is not just a bit of a cultural thing that, you know, maybe isn't the best. This is an endemic issue. And it's one that Sue Gray is urgently, you know, wanting us to take note of. They are drinking too much in Downing Street. Excessive consumption is actually what she calls it. Also, I was just thinking, you know, with excessive consumption comes hangovers, right? Unless you're Superman, unless you're one of those annoying people that doesn't get hangovers, who I just, most people, if they drink a lot, feel like total shit the next day. That's just kind of part of the deal. And on that basis, one can't help but wonder, you know, does this mean that staff were at least risking regular hangovers whilst they were dealing with a global pandemic that completely, you know, swept over the country and destroyed hundreds of thousands of lives. And the kind of caliber of issues they were dealing with, this was not light work. They were looking at PPE shortages. They were deciding what restrictions and what lockdowns to roll out. They were listening to briefings from epidemiologists and public health officials, scientists. They were having to understand and compute what scientists were telling them. This is the kind of thing I want government staff to feel well for. You know, I don't even like making this podcast when I'm a bit hungover. I try to avoid it at all times because the output, I mean, it's no fun to do, but also the output is fundamentally worse when I don't feel well. So I would hope that the people in government are, without sounding like a total square, looking after themselves because we've needed them to look after us. So that's just something I've been considering there. Right, so that's the fourth bullet point. The fifth bullet point talks about the use of the Downing Street garden, saying it was, quote, used for gatherings without clear authorisation or oversight. This was not appropriate, Gray says. Again, couldn't be more clear. You use the garden for things that you should not have been using the garden for. And yes, it's a private residence. And yes, it's Boris Johnson's entitlement to use it with his family or with other residents. But to just have a gaggle of people drinking isn't acceptable. And this is the thing. One of the kind of incriminating photographs of Boris Johnson showed him to be sitting outside drinking wine in the garden, which was his right to do. But that was all the while you could see in the background a gaggle of staff socialising and drinking. And that was all the proof that a lot of people needed to kind of evidence the fact that the PM had sanctioned a rule-breaking gathering because he was sitting in the foreground while it happened behind him. The sixth bullet point, so the penultimate thing, I mean, we're really rattling through this because it is so short, but yeah, the sixth bullet point also struck a chord with me because it commented on the wider culture at Downing Street, specifically how hard it seems to be to report your colleagues for misconduct. This is what it says, quote, some staff wanted to raise concerns about behaviour they witnessed at work, but at times felt unable to do so. No member of staff should feel unable to report or challenge poor conduct when they witness it. So, I mean, don't you think that's interesting? Sue Gray has sort of, again, this is such a priority that she's put it in this list, this short list, this inability amongst Downing Street staff to simply speak up when people aren't behaving like they should. And I mean, we all know that it is really awkward if you like see people breaking rules or doing something wrong, and then you're put in a position like, ugh. And I don't know, maybe it's a British thing, but we've got this horrible like fear of grassing on other people. So I maybe imagine that some of it is just this cultural kind of high school instinct. But she also talks about there's no informal route to comment on concerns. She talks about how like everything has to be very formal, and that puts people off because if it's just a concern, they just want to raise a concern, then they're too scared or too tired or too busy to go down this, you know, very formal complaints route. So again, it's a comment on not just the culture but also how Downing Street works and why it's not particularly fit for purpose in that sense. And then her final point is on the way that Downing Street actually works as an office. She notes that the number of people who work there has grown so much, but the structure of the place, so like the office, the hierarchy, just the way that it works, hasn't matched that expansion of staff. So she comments on the, quote, fragmented and complicated leadership structures, which she feels have meant that staff just don't know, like, who is accountable for what. And that has sometimes led to what she calls the blurring of lines of accountability. When I read that, I kind of picture, like, a startup. I don't know if any of you listening have ever worked for a startup, but it can be very fluid and fragmented and confusing. And yeah, it's exciting and you're all having to pitch in and do different jobs because there isn't, you know, say like a formal HR department or a really clear structure. And while that's cool, it's not ideal for fucking government, you know? That's what it makes me think of. The Office of the Prime Minister is not a startup. I want people to be able to report misconduct. I want people to know how to do that. I want people to know who's in charge of what. And I know that the pandemic has been a chaotic time and to some degree they'll have had to be flexible, but that's all the more reason why Downing Street should be a sophisticated and practical and functioning workplace. It should have everything clearly marked out so that if someone cocks up, then we know who did it and we know when and how and whose fault it is. Accountability, baby. And in chaos, accountability has lots of places to hide. So I don't take this view, this kind of, oh, well, we've got to be resilient and manoeuvrable and flexible, adaptable. I don't take that as an excuse for what Sue Gray has found here, that it's just not a functioning office. So yeah, that's her final point. Anyway, that's a hell of a tangent. That is literally the full list of all the findings. All that's left is the conclusion, which says, quote, "I have noted a number of these gatherings should not have been allowed to take place or to develop in the way that they did. There is significant learning to be drawn from these events, which must be addressed immediately across government." So that's the conclusion. I mean, is it disparaging? Yes. Does it confirm that Boris Johnson and members of his staff broke the rules? Yes, it does. But her conclusion here is that learning is needed. And, you know, that could mean anything from sort of lightly shaking up the structure of Downing Street a little bit, all the way to mass firings and resignations. Obviously, the opposition parties are reading this as a death knell for Boris Johnson's career, while Johnson himself and his allies are saying, right, cool, thank you for your points, Sue Gray, we'll maybe employ a couple more people to keep things running smoothly in the office, and then we'll move on. Sorry. So, yeah, this report, what it doesn't do is prescribe what should happen, nor did it ever promise to do that. It was just an investigation into what happened, and now we've only got these findings for now. So that vagueness and that lack of prescription is naturally going to result in arguments amongst politicians as to what should happen next. We will talk in more detail about everyone's responses to it in a second. I imagine it's quite easy to work out how different politicians have reacted. But I just want to quickly address the question of where is the rest of this bloody report? You know, Sue Gray's brief, like I say, was to, and this is the official wording, it was to complete an investigation into alleged gatherings on government premises during COVID restrictions. That's the brief. So you'd be forgiven for going, right, let's hear about these gatherings. If you've been investigating them, let's hear it. Who was there? What happened? Who organised them? You know, who are the big rule breakers here? Let's have some details. But here's the thing. On Friday the 29th of January, the Metropolitan Police, i.e. the London Police, announced that they didn't want Sue Gray to release the full thing. The reason being because they have ongoing investigations into most of these parties as well. And they were worried that Gray's report, if that came out, it might, quote unquote, prejudice their findings. This is what the Met statement said. Quote, "For the events that the Met is investigating, we asked for minimal reference to be made in the Cabinet Office report." So we asked for minimal reference to be made to those events in Sue Gray's report. "The Met did not ask for any limitations on other events in the report or for the report to be delayed." Now, when they're saying they didn't ask for the report to be delayed, maybe it didn't, but this has resulted in the report being delayed because Sue Gray hasn't been able to, well, she's been forced to make minimal reference, as they put it. So their intent might not have been for it to be delayed, but it has been, directly because of them. And when they say this thing about they didn't ask for any limitations on other events in the report, they're investigating most of the events that Sue Gray is investigating. I think the Met Police are looking into like 12 to see if laws were broken. Sue Gray was investigating sort of 16, 17. So saying that, you know, they've not asked for limitations on any other events isn't saying much, because there's hardly any events that they're not looking into. And one would assume that the ones they're not interested in are less incriminating, right? That's why they're not looking into them. So essentially, Sue Gray was put into a position where she had this binary choice. Do I publish a version of the report now where people can read about those four events that the police aren't investigating and the whole thing will seem quite soft, you know, because it'll look like nothing that bad happened because these are the least incriminating events. Do I do that? Or do I delay yet further, to the point where Julia Bell reaches the brink? And do I just publish it after the Met Police have finished what they need to do? But at least then I can put it all out there warts and all. So that was the kind of choice this Met police intervention gave her. And so her attitude was kind of, do you know what? You're not letting me talk about all of it, so I'm not going to talk about any of it. I'll simply give you these general findings, this very vague, quick sort of summary that doesn't infringe on the police's investigation. I'll read you, do you know, this is interesting. I might as well read you what she put. Quote, I have decided not to publish factual accounts in relation to those four dates. I do not feel that I am able to do so without detriment to the overall balance of the findings. More generally, I did consider whether it would be better to pause and wait until the conclusion of the police investigation before publishing anything. However, given the widespread public interest and concern about these matters, and to avoid any further delay, I am providing an update on the investigation and setting out some general findings now. So that's how she worded it. And I read that as, you know, if I put out these four dates, details on those, it will affect the balance of the overall thing. It will look like nothing that bad actually happened. So let's just wait and I'll give you the full thing. But for now, it almost she's giving us this trailer by giving us these general findings. That's her way of saying, look, I still want you to care about what comes out, even if it's in a few months. So let's just kind of whet your appetite with these quite disparaging sort of bullet points that are more vague and won't affect what the police is looking into. And I'm grateful that she did that, because who knows when the Met will be done investigating their stuff. You know, the last Prime Minister that was investigated by the police was Tony Blair, and that investigation took 16 months. Obviously, it was for a completely different reason. Still not a very good thing for a Prime Minister to be investigated by the police. And actually, this whole thing for Tony Blair sort of, I think for many people, undermined the end of his tenure completely, because he was being investigated for corruption. That was all about this cash for peerages scandal. And it might be before some of your time. It kind of is before mine. But basically what happened is, you know, there was suspicion that people were buying their way into the House of Lords, basically. And so the Met Police had to investigate. It took 16 months. And even though there were no charges, like I say, it didn't make him look great at the end of his tenure in Downing Street. Now, that being said, one would assume that having the police investigating Boris Johnson would do the same thing. It would undermine him in his tenure as well. And yet, we just live in a different time now. Kind of inversely, or perversely, you might say, the whole thing of the police getting involved has kind of helped him. Because the Met Police's intervention means, bottom line, we ain't going to see this Sue Gray report anytime soon. We might see versions of it. We might see updates of it. There are rumours that Boris Johnson might allow a little bit more to be visible to the public. But realistically, we might be holding out for ages to see the full thing. And so with Johnson's position kind of riding on and people not seeing that report, you know, lots of Conservative MPs are kind of waiting like coiled springs to trigger a vote of no confidence in the Prime Minister if they read the whole thing and they don't approve of it. And so by it being delayed, he's bought more time to stay put. And don't forget, these Conservative MPs who are thinking about triggering a vote of no confidence, their main motivation will be the views of their constituents. And recently they've been getting record numbers of angry emails from the people who voted them in. You know, you're my Conservative MP, you should get rid of Boris Johnson, I'm furious about these parties that happened, right? These are the emails they're getting. But if one can't help but wonder, if we delay and delay and delay like we have been to get this full report, it might result in the public kind of dampening down their anger. You can only be angry for so long, you know, at such intensity. So could we get to a point where the report comes out a few months down the line, it's really bad, bad enough that these Conservative MPs would have triggered votes of no confidence if it came out now. But because we've moved on a little bit and people aren't as angry anymore, Boris Johnson gets to stay put. And these Conservative MPs go, oh, forget it, let's just move on. Like, is that a possibility? This is something I've been thinking of. If anyone was going to survive by default in that way, it's Boris Johnson. This man is made of Teflon. But anyway, there's no point predicting the future. These are just things I've been considering. And you'll notice that the Prime Minister is indeed using this police investigation as a way to avoid a grilling on Sue Gray's findings, you know, and sort of push back the debate and delay the whole issue. Because when people press him on it, his line, true and tested, is, look, let's just wait to see what the police say. Back in the day, 2 weeks ago, his line was, let's just wait to see what Sue Gray says. And now the Met Police have intervened, he gets to say, well, let's just see what the police say. There's always a let's just wait and see excuse that he's able to offer. Or not excuse, but sort of get out clause, if you like. And in that sense, it's very weird to see a Prime Minister almost benefiting from a police investigation. Right, speaking of giving the Prime Minister a grilling, let's talk about the extremely tense session that he faced in the House of Commons on Monday the 31st of January, obviously as a result of this, the release of this Sue Gray report, or a very redacted version of it. First of all, let's listen to his initial statement.
And first, I want to express my deepest gratitude to Sue Gray and all the people who have contributed to this report, which I have placed in the library of this House, and which the government has published in full today for everyone to read. I will address its findings in this statement, but firstly, I want to say sorry. And I'm sorry for the things we simply didn't get right, and also sorry for the way that this matter has been handled. And it's no use saying that this or that was within the rules, and it's no use saying that people were working hard. This pandemic was hard for everyone. We asked people across this country to make the most extraordinary sacrifices, not to meet loved ones, not to visit relatives before they died. And I understand the anger that people feel. But Mr. Speaker, it isn't enough to say sorry. This is a moment when we must look at ourselves in the mirror and we must learn. And while the Metropolitan Police must yet complete their investigation, and that means there are no details of specific events in Sue Gray's report, I, of course, accept Sue Gray's general findings in full. And above all, her recommendation that we must learn from these events and act now.
Boris Johnson there, making his statement and apology to the House of Commons and to the wider world on the 31st of January, 2022. Now, that was met with, I was going to say disdain, but disdain isn't quite strong enough a word. Let's go vitriol, because to be honest, that's what it was. It was met with vitriol from Keir Starmer, the leader of the Labour Party and therefore leader of the opposition, who ultimately called the Prime Minister void of integrity and unfit for office, calling him to, quote, do the decent thing and resign. Do you know what? I'll actually play you a clip of that exchange, because when I was watching it, I was quite taken aback by the anger between both Boris Johnson and Keir Starmer. I know they're not best buddies, and they likely never will be, but they usually kind of keep their lids on when they're in these debates. But this got kind of personal. Have a listen.
But Prime Minister, the British public aren't fools. They never believed a word of it. They think the Prime Minister should do the decent thing and resign. Yeah. Of course he won't, because he is a man without shame. His colleagues have spent weeks defending the indefensible, touring the TV studios, parroting his absurd denials, degrading themselves and their offices. There are members opposite who know that. The question they must now ask themselves is, what are they going to do about it? It is only they that can end this farce. The eyes of the country are upon them. They will be judged by the decisions they take now.
Yeah. Yeah. Prime Minister!
Well, Mr. Speaker, there's a reason why he said absolutely nothing about the report that was presented by this government and laid and put in the Library of the House earlier on today. That is because, Mr. Speaker, the report does absolutely nothing to substantiate the tissue of nonsense he has just spoken. Instead, Mr. Speaker, this leader of the opposition, a former director of public prosecutions, Mr. Speaker, he spent most of his time prosecuting journalists and failing to prosecute Jimmy Savile, as far as I can make out, Mr. Speaker.
There we go. Keir Starmer and Boris Johnson coming to blows in the Commons on Monday the 31st of January. But Starmer was not the only hostile voice in that room. Of course, the Liberal Democrats and the Greens, you know, these opposition parties are furious. The SNP, the Scottish National Party, oh my goodness, characteristically furious because already they are not the biggest fans of the Conservative Party and the Conservative government. But that's not to say that all the Conservatives were happy. You know, not at all. Theresa May, ex-Conservative Prime Minister, Boris Johnson's predecessor, she did not hold back at all. Have a listen to this.
What the Grey Report does show is that Number 10 Downing Street was not observing the regulations they had imposed on members of the public. So either my right honourable friend had not read the rules, or didn't understand what they meant, and others around him, or they didn't think the rules applied to Number 10. Which was it?
I mean, wow, Theresa May there on the 31st of January basically asking, did you not know about the rules, or did you not care about the rules? Which is it? And that which is it, like it has to be one of these two, and both of them are terrible. Both of them make you look really bad. Do you know what was quite interesting about that as well was Theresa May obviously made that really critical comment and asked that very closed, incriminating question. And then Ian Blackford, the leader of the SNP, the Scottish National Party, who, like I say, no fan of the Conservatives at all, he stood up and was so complimentary of Theresa May. Like, he was talking about her level of integrity and how she, you know, made the office of the Prime Minister proud. Like, she did that job with dignity and with respect, and how, you know, Boris Johnson was nothing compared to her. And it was just quite a surreal moment to see the leader of the SNP and the ex-leader of the Conservative Party kind of almost join forces. I mean, Theresa May didn't reply. She just sat with her head down looking very stern. But to see the SNP leader just be like so complimentary of a Conservative in general was really something. It just shows how pissed off people are with Boris Johnson and how the kind of level of anger is almost a uniting force between unlikely allies. But like I say, Theresa May took this real stance, and it wasn't just her. Plenty of other Conservatives kind of followed suit, most notably Andrew Mitchell, who... I mean, my God, he has been like a multi-decade-long supporter of Boris Johnson. There are stories of him coaching Boris Johnson to further his political career decades ago. And Mitchell has supported Johnson very loyally through all these various scandals that we've seen since he came into office in summer 2019. But it appears now he's reached his limit. Listen.
Does my right honourable friend recall that ever since he joined the party's candidates list 30 years ago, until we got him into Number 10, he has enjoyed my full-throated support. But I am deeply concerned by these events, and very concerned indeed by some of the things he has said from that dispatch box and has said to the British public and our constituents. When he kindly invited me to see him 10 days ago, I told him that I thought he should think very carefully about what was now in the best interests of our country and of the Conservative Party. And I have to tell him he no longer enjoys my support.
Andrew Mitchell there, long-time ally of the... Maybe not even ally, friend. I would have maybe used the word friend of the Prime Minister. But I guess he's kind of reached his limit, like I say. And that was quite something, considering the fact that, again, we don't have the details of this report. This is all off the back of seven general findings, seven very vague general bullet points. Once we hear details of these parties, I think, you know, more drama should presumably unfold if it only took seven bullet points for Andrew Mitchell to turn against Boris Johnson. And I think the crux of this issue, you know, I think we're all asking, why now? Why this? Why this moment? What is it about that that so many of even Johnson's loyal backers are starting to edge away? And I think it all comes down to this theme of being misled. Like, that question that none of us ever want to ask, have I been lied to? Have I been lied to by someone that I thought was my friend or my colleague or somebody I could trust? Have they looked at me and told me something they know wasn't true? And so if you just kind of bear that sentiment in mind while I turn your attention back to the 8th of December, when the now infamous and immortal video of Allegra Stratton came out to the world, and she was seen to be sort of joking about this Downing Street party, or she kind of coyly put it, a business meeting with cheese and wine. And this is what Johnson said to his colleagues in the Commons at the time, on the 8th of December, so it wasn't that long ago.
I've been repeatedly assured that no rules were broken, Mrs. Speaker, and I understand public anxiety about this, and I understand public indignation, but that is, but there is a risk of doing a grave injustice to people who are frankly obeying the rules, Mr. Speaker.
So there he was on the 8th of December, and the language is very passive, isn't it? I have been assured that no parties happened, because I don't know. You know, I couldn't tell you, I couldn't assure you myself, because I wasn't there. I wasn't a part of any of it. So that was just such distance from these accusations and reports. And then if you zoom out now, he's much closer to it, isn't he? Because he's having to apologise not only for the parties that happened, but also for the parties that he himself attended. I mean, obviously his line on this is that he didn't know they were parties and he thought they were work events, and he's really sticking to that story. Nonetheless, I think we've got to a point where you compare that messaging to now, and, you know, even some of his closest allies just don't buy it anymore. Now that leads us to the conversation of next steps. What happens now? Is he going to resign? Will we be in this sort of perpetual state of limbo for the rest of time? Will the findings of Sue Gray go down in history as one of the great mysteries of the world alongside the construction of the pyramids? Well, what we do know is, yes, there's been lots of calls for Boris Johnson's resignation. I mean, I think there were more than I've ever heard before in that session in the House of Commons on Monday, the 31st of January. But despite that, the PM does not intend to resign. At the time of recording, he's not even acknowledged the question. And like literally every other question from MPs was, are you going to resign? Are you going to resign? And he just didn't even answer. He would kind of move the conversation on. Instead of resigning, his approach has been to plan some much easier solutions, I would say, to Sue Gray's findings, including shaking up how Downing Street operates. So you know how she had that bullet point about the blurred lines and accountability because of the structure of Downing Street and how it works? Well, Johnson's addressing that. This is what he said, quote, "It is time to sort out what Sue Gray rightly calls the fragmented and complicated leadership structures of Downing Street, and we will do that, including by creating an office of the Prime Minister with a permanent secretary to lead Number 10. So a bit of an HR shuffle and a appointment of a new role. So that's the kind of part of the game plan to address the structural issue. Safe to say, Johnson's critics aren't satisfied by that at all. But his other solution, and I've talked about this in past episodes, is policy. Let's talk about what we are doing right, or what at least their voters will hopefully view that they're doing right. So let's wow the public with results. You'll notice Boris Johnson adopts this technique that, you know, if ever you get media training, like if ever you've had to do PR you've had media training, they will teach you this technique. It's called bridging. It's where you're asked a question, you don't really want to answer that, so you bridge to talk about something you do want to answer. This is what he does. I'm sorry about the Sue Gray thing. That's a shame. I won't do that. But look at all the things we are doing. Brexit, we got that done. We're going to have a real show of strength in the face of threats from Russia. We're going to keep the conversation going about binning off the BBC licence fee. Look at the amazing booster jab rollout we've got. You know, this getting on with the job mentality is absolutely what Johnson's kind of solution is to this. And I think he's hoping that if he can show the British public, like, look at all these results I'm putting out, it will make them go, okay, so you had a couple of parties, but I would definitely prefer you in charge over anyone else. So that's kind of the game plan, I think, judging by how he's responded to these questions. But of course, it's not all in his hands, right? There is that chance that he could have to face a vote of no confidence. And what is that chance, I hear you ask? Well, if you listen to my last episode of the podcast, I did explain kind of how the whole process of no confidence works. But essentially, 54 Conservative MPs need to submit letters declaring their desire to get rid of the Prime Minister in order to trigger that vote. And that process where they submit these letters is secret. They don't have to tell anybody that they've done that, which is very annoying for us because we've no idea if, you know, maybe 53 people have submitted letters and it just takes one, or maybe only 20 have. I think the general consensus is that a few dozen have already. Again, nothing's 100%, but enough kind of rumours and like unnamed sources and what have you have kind of confirmed that maybe between sort of 20 and 40 have submitted letters. Don't quote me on that though, because again, like I say, it's all in secret and it's all via rumours. Except there are a few that are perfectly happy to just come out and say, yep, I submitted a letter and I'm proud of the fact. So there are a few kind of conservative rebels, if you like, that are very open about the fact that they want to get rid. But bear in mind as well, even if 54 letters come through, it doesn't just boot him out immediately. Then they actually have the vote of no confidence. Are you yes or no? Do you want to kick him out? And he may well survive that. So just if we get 54 letters, it's not the end of the story. What I will say as well, just before I leave you, is the Met Police, oh man, like they did not need more distrust, like more public resentment. And that's exactly what they've got, to be honest, as a result of them kind of intervening. Because remember, they initially said, in response to these reports of parties at Downing Street, they initially said, oh, we're not going to investigate that. We're not going to look into it because it's too retrospective, they said. As if, because something's already happened, you can't look into it. Since when is that how the law works? But they also said, look, there's just not enough evidence to justify a big scale investigation. So that was their first stance on this. Then when Sue Gray kind of kicked off her report and reportedly hundreds of pictures and WhatsApps and emails flooded in that presumably are somewhat incriminating, then the police changed their mind. I guess because there was suddenly quite a lot of evidence and said, actually, yes, we will investigate and we'll investigate these ones, but there's four that we won't bother with, you know. And that is why people, I think, are even more irritated, because it's like, well, first of all, you said you weren't going to bother. Then you said you did. And not only are you going to bother now, but you're actually going to prevent Sue Gray from coming out with her evidence. So you're just getting in the way. And I'm sure in the meantime, the Prime Minister will carry on with this tact of saying, look, I think what the British public want to hear about is what we're doing. I don't think they want to hear about us talking about ourselves. They want to hear about the jobs we're doing. And can I just say, this is how I feel about that. Can politicians stop telling me how to feel? Can they stop telling me what I am interested in? And can they stop assuming that I only have the capacity to concentrate on one thing at a time? I don't. I can definitely follow this scandal, follow this investigation, as well as, Prime Minister, as well as finding out what you're actually doing with policy. So I hate it. And it's not just the Conservatives that are guilty of this. Lots of politicians try to do it, although it is one of Boris Johnson's favourite tactics. Oh, the public don't want to know about this. This is what the public actually want. What the public want is accountability, clarity and policy. And I think we're capable of keeping track of all of it. Thank you very much. Anyway, rant over. Thank you for listening. Let me know your thoughts on everything we've discussed today. You can follow me on social media at @JuliaBell_X. And I would ask, if you're listening to this on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify, please subscribe and please give it 5 stars. If you can click 5 stars, because on Spotify you can also rate podcasts now. And if you do all 5, it really helps other people find me. And to use this podcast as a resource for helping them understand politics too. So thank you so much for that. And if you want to keep this podcast going, you want to ensure that it can carry on forever, then please do become a patron. The link is in the episode description and you can become a part of that community, but also get loads of exclusive content. I recently wrote a piece about who the candidates might be to succeed Boris Johnson if we ever get to that point. And I sort of outlined the likelihood of each one and what their policies might look like. I've also done a piece more recently about Joe Lycett, the comedian, and how he somehow fooled members of the government into thinking that he had access to Sue Gray's report before they did. So that was a great story that I covered too. So click the link in the description if you want to get involved in that. And with that, I hope you have a fabulous first week of February. I turned 30 on the 3rd of February, so in a couple of days. So if you see poor behaviour on social media, then that's why. But yeah, I promise not to do this podcast when I'm worse for wear, that's for sure. Take care, everyone. I'll speak to you in the next one.